Welcome everyone as we continue our journey through Parshat Mishpatim, through the covenant code, through the laws that appear in the Torah immediately after the Ten Commandments. Let's just get this screen showing the slides. Okay, I hope everyone can see the slides now, and we can proceed. Okay, so we get back to laws of slaves now, after the laws that we saw last week, and I know that it isn't the most pleasant topic, but it's here in the text, and in fact, there are some not particularly not pleasant parts of this text that we'll be studying today. When a person strikes a slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies there and then, that's the JPS translation of tachat yado. I guess literally it means that struck the slave, and it means under your hand, like right there from having struck the slave with a rod, then he must be avenged. The text doesn't make it clear precisely what that means, nakom yinakem, and we'll talk about that, but the halacha is very clear about this. The halacha says he must be avenged. This means execution by the sword, mitzat saif, which is the same punishment that the rabbinic Judaism says any murderer gets. So at least rabbinic Judaism understands this text as saying that killing a slave is tantamount to killing somebody who is not a slave. It is a capital crime. And just as it said beforehand, that there is the capital penalty for killing another person. So that law here, it says here, applies also to the slave. Rashi quotes an old Midrash Halacha that says that the reason that we know that nakom yinakem means that a capital punishment is because that the same language is used in Leviticus in the phrase cherev nokemet nekam berit, a sword avenging the vengeance of my covenant. And so we see nokemet nekam is connected to the sword, and so that's why we know that there is this this penalty. This is the halacha on this subject. Ibn Ezra mentions that, as Ibn Ezra often does in his commentary, he gets into an argument with the Karaites, whom he calls the Minim. When commentators in the 12th century, we were living in Christian countries, used the word minim, they mean the Christians. When commentators who come from Sephardic countries, like Ibn Ezra does, when he uses the word minim, most of the time he's referring to the Karaites. And he says that the Karaites say that the meaning of nakom yinakem is that great vengeance shall be exacted, namely, that the master shall be beaten. I've shortened this comment of Ibn Ezra. Anybody wants to see it in a greater length, you can look it up in books and in fine online resources that make these commentaries available, both in Hebrew and in English. And it seems that Karaites, at least some of the Karaites, argued, I'm sure everybody knows, so the Karaites are, just in case there are one or two people who don't, it's a a friend of mine, Professor Daniel Lasker, some of you might have attended his lecture series on the Karaites here at Torah in Motion. That was a month or two ago, if I remember correctly. Professor Lasker has called the Karaites the longest surviving group of alternative Judaism. It's another interpretation of Judaism, and it's an interpretation that theoretically is understood as being more literal in its understanding of the Torah. As Professor Lasker and others have pointed out, it's not all that literal. They also have their own traditions, but they one thing that is definitely be said about the Karaites is that they reject the traditional rabbinic, or we could call it rabbinites. That's the adjective that is used to describe a Jew who isn't a Karaite, a Jew who is a rabbinite and is one who follows the rabbinic interpretation of the text. Anyways, it seems that the common Karaite interpretation here of Nakom Yinakem, as Ibn Ezra makes clear in this commentary, is that this language was used that is unclear, kind of on purpose, because the crime here will depend on how cruel the the punishment here will depend on how cruel the action of the master was. And that we will flog the Karaites say we will flog, we will inflict physical punishment on the owner who killed his own slave, and sometimes we'll inflict just a little bit of punishment, and sometimes we'll inflict a lot of punishment, and that's why it says Nakom Yinakem. Ibn Ezra says, Chol ze haya kasher lehem she yehareg ha'adon ba'avur mot ha'eved. He says their real difficulty lies in accepting the idea that the master would be executed because of the death of a slave, which was not something that everybody was saying. As we said before, and as we'll say a little further, but Ibn Ezra is estimating that the real problem that the Karaites had with the rabbinic interpretation here is that they did not like the idea of saying that a master who kills his own slave would be put to death for doing this. And then Ibn Ezra, again, I'm not giving you the whole comment here, tries to provide a number of textual arguments about why it makes more sense to say that the words Nakom Yinakem, he must be avenged, apply more accurately to the capital penalty than to corporal punishment, as the Karaites suggested. And then Ibn Ezra says what he often says in his debates with the Karaites, and we'll see him again kind of expanding on this in a text that we're going to see next week. He says, this is an important part of Ibn Ezra's worldview. Anybody who disputes the words of our sages and the Talmudic rabbis are forced to rely on them with regard to the phrase, Nakom Yinakem. Why? Shahan nekama al derachim rabim. You know, this is the point that Ibn Ezra makes frequently. The Torah is not a sufficient document the way it is written. If you just look at the Torah Shebichtav, at the written Torah, you know, you see here, Nakom Yinakem, and you scratch your head and you say, I don't know what that means. But clearly, the author, the divine author, must know that people are not going to know what Nakom Yinakem means, and that some tradition is going to be required. Well, because shahad nekama al derachim rabim, there are many ways of taking vengeance. Logic will not help them in this case. That Karaites often say that all you need in order to interpret the Bible is sevara. Actually, a number of the Karaites argue that you will need something more than Svara, but at least the earlier Karaites, the earliest Karaites often argued that all you really need is the text and your own brain, and you don't need the Talmudic rabbis. He says, methodologically, you see that it doesn't work when you get to a phrase here like Nakom Yinakim, because it doesn't, because it could be interpreted in so many ways, and assuming that the Torah wants you to know what to do in this case, then the Torah must be dependent on the fact that it comes like with this interpretive manual of the rabbinic literature, which tells you, the Torah Sheba'al Peh tells you how to interpret the text. And just, this is a text that we saw a number of weeks ago when we started talking about slaves. I just want to remind people about what the status of killing slaves was in the ancient world and in the medieval world and into the modern world, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica. An owner could kill his slave, just without any punishment, with impunity, in Homeric Greece, in ancient India, in the Roman Republic, in Islamic countries, in Anglo-Saxon England, in medieval Russia, and in many parts of the American South, until 1830. There were various attempts to change this. The Code of Justinian in the 6th century CE changed the definition of a slave from a thing to a person and prescribed the death penalty for an owner who killed his slave by torture, poison, or fire. If you used a really cruel method of killing your slave, then the Code of Justinian in the 6th century said, okay, that's a capital crime. Spanish law in the 1260s and 1270s denied owners the right to kill their slaves. So there were various attempts in the last couple thousand years to change the law about this, but they didn't catch on, in Anglo-Saxon England and in many parts of the American South before 1830. It was, you just couldn't bring a slave owner to justice for killing their slave. One thing that I should have mentioned in the beginning of the discussion here is that in rabbinic understanding of this text is not talking about the same slave that we were talking about in the beginning of this chapter, Ki Tiknet Eved Ivri. It's not talking about purchasing a slave who is a Hebrew. It's talking about a slave who is not a Hebrew, and because the kind of assumption is that it's totally clear that a Hebrew slave cannot be killed and that there's a capital penalty for killing a Hebrew slave. But here, even the slaves that were purchased who were not Israelites, there's the death penalty for killing your own slave. Okay, so that's the beginning of this little text here about the slave. The text then goes on. At the bottom of the screen here, you see the continuation of the let's start at the bottom. When a man strikes a slave, male or female, with a rod, and he dies there and then, he must be avenged. But if he survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, since he is the other's property. So the first thing that this text is saying at the bottom of the screen here is that there is the capital penalty for killing your own slave. However, if he doesn't die then and there, then there isn't the death penalty if the slave survives for a while. And it is clear that this text is written as a contrast to the text that we saw last week, which is at the top of the screen here. When men quarrel, and one of them strikes the other one with stone or fist, and he does not die, but has to take to his bed, if he then gets up and he walks outdoors upon his staff. The assailant shall go unpunished. He won't get the capital penalty for an action of this nature, except the assailant shall go unpunished, except that he must pay for his idleness and for his cure, that there's a monetary penalty instead of the capital penalty. So the commentators notice, and Rafam says this very clearly here, if he then gets up and he walks, this is on Inyakum Bihitalech Bahuz, but if he does not get up and walk, but rather he dies as a result of the blow, even a long time later, then the one who struck him shall be put to death. As we saw when we studied this text last week, the question was trying to determine the relationship between the death of this slave and the death of this person and the fact that he was struck. And that since there weren't autopsies and no ability to kind of see what the real cause of death was, The Torah gives us this formula here that you can tell that he was cured if he was walking around outside. That's the text that we saw last week. But the situation with the slave is different, as the text says. There's the capital penalty in the standard rabbinic understanding here. If he dies then and there, but if he survives a day or two, then there isn't a capital penalty. Why? Since he is the other's property, he chaspo hu, and Rafam says, aval ba'avdo eino chayav ela met tachat yado, aval in yomo yomayim yamod patur. However, with the slave, he is not culpable unless the slave dies there and then. But if he survives a day or two, then the owner is not culpable. So, in looking at what this text is doing here, we saw a number of capital crimes in Exodus 21. And then we come to this case here in verses 18 and 19, where we're trying to decide, was this murder or wasn't it murder? Did the person die because he was hit? Or did he die? Or do we not attribute his death to the fact that he was hit? And they give you a formula here, and they say that a different formula is to be applied when it is a slave who is involved. But there's still the standard rabbinic understanding, there is still this, it's a capital crime if you kill the slave, but with the slave, there's a different formula that is applied. We're going to see either later today or next week, depending on how quickly we move along through the text here, we're going to see that in the Court of Hammurabi, constant differences are being made between damages that are done to a slave and damages that are done to a person who is not a slave. At least in the standard rabbinic understanding of this text, there is no real difference between killing a slave and killing a free person. Both of them are capital crimes, and only in assessing whether the action is to be attributed to the beating, only there is there a difference, and the commentators talk about it. Again, this is not the most pleasant thing. I think these are good interpretations of the text. Rashbam writes here, ki kaspohu, v'dino l'hakoto derach tochachau. What is the meaning of saying that there isn't a death penalty in this situation if he survives for a couple of days after he is beaten? So the Torah says, well, after all, kaspohu, since the slave is his property, and he's entitled to beat him for the sake of discipline. That's what people did with slaves to get them to behave, and there's an understanding that this would be acceptable. Shadal, Samuel David Luzzatto in the 19th century, phrases it a little differently. I think it's a nice addition to what Rashbam wrote. Shadal says, since he is the other's property and he is allowed to discipline, him. Also, it's hard to imagine that he intended to kill the slave, since he would be losing his investments. That it doesn't make sense for a person to kill their slave, because they invested money to buy this slave, and so why would they kill the slave? But the simpler understanding here is that since beating of slaves is something that is expected to be happening, if one really overdoes it and the slave dies tachat yado, as you're beating them, then obviously you didn't understand what it means to beat a slave. Beating a slave does not mean to kill the slave. It means to beat them up to the point that they'll be willing to cooperate. And if you get carried away with yourself and you kill them there and then, you get the death penalty for that. But if you miscalculated, you thought that you were beating the slave in a permissible manner, in a useful manner, and then it ends up that the slave dies later on, not then and there, then the Torah says that that is not a capital case. So the first thing to say about this text is it may be relevant to an understanding of the order of laws in Exodus chapter 21. Now, I just said that the rabbis understood that the laws here about the slave are not the laws about the same slave that is mentioned in the beginning of the chapter. We're talking about Eved Ivri. Halacha is very clear that an Eved Ivri, you would not say about an Eved Ivri, ki kaspohu, that his property, an Israelite slave is not the property of the Israelite owner. The rabbis even said, Misha kana eved ivri kana lo rav. If you ever buy a Hebrew slave, you've actually bought an owner, because the Torah gives the Hebrew slave so many rights. But on the shot level, it looks like in the beginning of the chapter, it just starts with laws of slaves. And then it gets into various laws dealing with homicide and with honor to parents and things of that nature. And then it says, and in a case where you can't really decide was it homicide or wasn't it homicide, there is a difference between a slave and a free person. So we were wondering what the why this law code began with slaves. We saw various thoughts about the subject. And another argument that has been made by people who look at the pshat and don't look at the rabbinic interpretation of the text is that because the Code of Hammurabi, as we will see either later today or next week, because of the Code of Hammurabi is always making distinctions between slaves and free persons, the Torah begins by giving you some basic principles about slaves, that they only stay for 6 years and then they go free. And then it tells you the small number of ways in which the Torah sees a distinction between between laws of torts and laws of that nature that apply both to free people and to slaves. So that could be a different understanding of why chapter 21 is organized in the way that it is organized. One more thing to say about this text. Rashi, quoting the Mechelta, the traditional Midrash Halacha, the traditional rabbinic interpretation, halachic interpretation of the book of Shmot, says, why does it say that you are beating your slave of Shevet? Rashi says, "V'sheyesh lo kedei lahamit hakatzut medaber." Scripture speaks of a rod that is capable of inflicting death. Last week, for those of you who were here last week, we talked a little bit about this principle of that in order for something to be a capital crime, then the murder weapon has to be a lethal weapon. And we had a long discussion last week about whether it makes sense to say that an edroch, a fist, is a lethal weapon that would be causing death. And so Rashi says, okay, why does it say here bashevet? And this is the traditional halachic understanding that it says here bashevet is because everybody who owns a shevet, who owns a rod that can be used to discipline a slave, should realize that the rod is a lethal weapon, that if it is used in a certain way, it is going to be a lethal weapon. So that's what Rashi says on the subject. And then along comes his grandson, Rashbam, and says, Vashefet, bedavar she'adam ragil lahakot et avdo lahochicho. With an instrument, why does it say with a rod? In other words, with an instrument with which a man is wont to strike his slave
to discipline him.
In other words, it didn't use the example of a rod because a rod is the lethal weapon. It used the example of a rod because a rod is something that you might find a master using to discipline their slave. And then he goes on. Aval b'cherev lefi hapshat. But following the plain meaning of scripture, if he struck him with a sword, then even if the slave were to die after a day or two, the owner would be liable for the death penalty. A sword is not an instrument of discipline, but an instrument of murder. So you see how Rashbam has flipped this. Instead of seeing the use of rod to tell him that rod is a lethal weapon, and if you use the implication of Rashi's understanding and the Mechilta's understanding is that this law applies anytime you're using a lethal weapon for hitting your slave, and Rashbam says no, that just looking at the chat of the text, it's saying that this leniency that you have, that if the slave dies a few days later, it won't be considered a capital crime. That's only in the case where the beating is with a rod. But if a slave owner were to use a sword against his slave, and the slave were to die a week later, a month later, a year later, then the leniency of they say, well, we expect this person to be disciplining their slave. Well, we don't expect anybody to be disciplining their slave with a sword, and so the leniency would not apply. That's Rashbam. Rashbam writes here that this is Lefi Hapshat. Now, why does he write Lefi Hapshat? Because he knows that he can't find any evidence of this in rabbinic literature. And this is a law, which, sadly, was probably applied here and there in Jewish history, because as we said in previous classes, Jews did own slaves. And presumably there were cases of of the owners of slaves who got carried away with themselves when they were trying to discipline their slaves. But in the halakhic literature, no one ever came up with this point. And the question is the extent that halakha is determined by rabbis in the Middle Ages or in more modern times, let's say, going back to the Bible and say, when the Bible said this, this is what it meant. So Rashbam realizes that he's doing something kind of unusual here. He's going back to the biblical verse and he's trying to learn a halakha from a careful reading of a biblical verse. And when it says, with a rod, even though the standard halachic literature says, oh, why does it say a rod? Sheyesh bo kedei la'amid, because it's a lethal weapon. It's something that's capable of inflicting death. And Rashbam says, no, if you look at the pshat, which, you know, we were talking before about Karaites and Rabbinites. Karaites say, you look at the text and you have to try to figure out from the text what the halacha is. So Rashbam says this. You know, I wonder if we were in Rashbam's Beit Midrash and you said to Rashbam, okay, do you think that that is halacha? I generally feel that when Rashbam offers a pshat interpretation of a legal text in the Bible, he's saying, you know, this is what it means, but I'm not, but halacha is determined by the way it's written in rabbinic literature. I'm not sure that Rashbam would say, yes, that is halacha. On the other hand, while Rashbam does this, curiously, Rambam does the same thing a few years after Rashbam. I have no reason to think that Rambam ever saw Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. Some of you who have studied Rambam, the Mishnah Torah, know that the phrase that he uses here in the beginning of this text, Yera Eli, this is code language when Rambam is saying something in his law code and he's saying, I had no source for it. When Rambam wrote his code of law, the Mishneh Torah, he made it clear that there wouldn't be any footnotes and there wouldn't be any sources, but that everything that he was writing is coming from a traditional rabbinic literature, except when he wrote a law that begins Yera Eli. And so here he begins his law on this subject by saying, Yera Eli, it appears to me that if someone struck their slave with a knife or a sword or a stone or an egrof, I decided not to translate egrof because last week we saw more than one interpretation of what an egrof actually is, or anything of that nature, and the injured, sorry for the spelling mistake, I'll try to fix it before I send in the slides later. And the injured party was assessed as being in mortal danger and then later died. The leniency of a day or two does not apply. Even if the slave were to die a year later, it would be a capital crime. And so Rambam takes this idea. So Rambam, there's been some literature written recently about Rambam's commitment to pshat. It certainly wasn't to the extent of Rashbam's commitment to pshat, but here he's allowing himself to go back to the logical analysis of the biblical text and say, the biblical text says that there's this leniency that applies when a slave owner uses a rod against a slave, then that is only if they're using a rod, because you don't use a knife or a sword or a stone or an egrof when you are trying to discipline a slave. L'chach ne'amar b'shevet, Rambam says, that's why the Torah says with a rod, for the Torah gave the owner permission to strike the slave only with a rod or a stick or a strap, but not with a murderous striking. Lo b'hata'at retzicha. So, you know, as somebody who's very interested in the history of biblical interpretation, I find it interesting to find Rashbam, and then just like a generation and a half later, Rambam, both coming up with this interpretation of the text. To the best of my knowledge, nobody came up with this interpretation beforehand, and Rambam even putting it into his halachic work as this is what Jewish law is. Although he says, I don't have any source for saying this, Yera Eli, through my understanding of the text. Okay. So we now move on to the next section of text, and it's even hard to say that these four verses coming up, to say, what is the theme of the text coming up here? As we shall see, these texts present a number of interpretive issues. Here's the text, a famous text that gets quoted all the time, and that is we will see, begin to see this week, and we'll see more about this next week. This is a text that is often quoted in abortion debates, and we'll talk about that, about how the text is read. But before we get to that issue, first of all, we should read the text. We will see that there are many translation issues here, but for now, we're just going to read the JPS translation here on the right-hand side of the screen. When men fight, and one of them pushes a pregnant woman, and a miscarriage results, but no other damage ensues, the one responsible shall be fined according as the woman's husband may exact from him, the payment to be based on reckoning. But if other damage ensues, the penalty shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. We will talk at length next week about the eye for eye interpretive problem. But before we get to that issue, and before we get to the issue about the fetus, let's just think about the beginning of this text. When the text says, "V'chi yinatzu anashim v'nagafu isha hara," that's a funny way of describing the situation here. The text doesn't say, "Ki yigof ish isha hara." It doesn't say, if a man pushes a pregnant woman. What the text does say is that men are fighting with each other and one of them pushes a pregnant woman. The standard understanding of this text is, and I think that it's a reasonable reading of the text, that it means by accident, that the men are trying to injure each other, and perhaps they're even trying to kill each other, and they end up damaging or perhaps killing, in the continuation of the passage, they end up damaging somebody else who they were not trying to damage. So that's, I think that that's the reasonable way of reading the first six words of this verse in Hebrew, V'chi yinatzu anashim v'nagafu isha hara. This verse ends up being at the center of a long debate in the Talmud, in the Babylonian Talmud, about the principle of nitkaven laharog et ze v'harag et ze. Is the discussion in the Talmud. A fascinating ethical question. If a person is trying to kill X, but by mistake ends up killing Y, if I walk into a room that's filled with a whole bunch of people, and one of these people is named John, and I say, "John, I've been looking for you for years. I am going to kill you." And I take out a gun and I shoot, and I don't kill John, but I kill Joseph instead of John. Why? Because I'm a lousy shot. That is the example that the Talmud calls nitkaven laharog etzeh. There's a long discussion in the Talmud about whether that constitutes first-degree murder. And sometimes, you know, when I used to teach about this stuff at York University, sometimes I get a classroom discussion going about the subject. Do you think that that constitutes first-degree murder to when you were trying to murder somebody, but you end up murdering somebody who wasn't the person that you were trying to murder? So Rashi says, that the way of reading this text, and I agree that it seems to be the simple way of understanding this text, when men fight with each other and one of them intended to strike the other one, and he inadvertently struck the woman. If that's how you understand the text here, and if you use the standard understanding, we're going to say that there's more than one understanding of this, but if you use the standard understanding of what's here is like the second paragraph here, which is, we'll see soon, the general way in which Jewish tradition has understood this means if the woman ends up dying, then the text would be saying, that if one man was trying to kill another man and ends up instead of that killing a woman, then v'natata nefesh tachad nefesh, the penalty shall be life for life. We'll say more about that part of this text later, next week, in fact. So Rashi understands this text as being about the intentionality problem that's the first thing that this text is talking about, harming somebody who wasn't the person that you were trying to harm. You were trying to harm somebody, but you weren't trying to harm this person. And if you deal with anything other than killing, we have a general rule. The general rule in halacha is adam muad lo olam ben er ben yashen. Any damage that I do, if I do damage to another human being by accident, I am still culpable according to halacha, and I have to make all of the same payments that I would have to pay to them if I damaged them on purpose. So when it comes to everything other than killing, we don't really care about intentionality. All of the categories that we talked about last week, that I mentioned last week, Nezek Tzar, Ripui Shevet, and Boshet, the five kinds of payments that are assessed when you damage another human being are assessed even if you didn't have intentionality. That intentionality is crucial in assessing culpability in a capital case, in a case of murder. And so Rashi says that this text is saying something about the halachic category of mitkaven that chaviro v'ikah taisha mitkaven laharog et zeh v'harag et zeh. Rambam in his law code provides the psach halacha. Hamitkaven laharog et zeh v'harag et zeh patur mimitat beitin. The beitin will not put somebody to death if they ended up killing the person that they weren't trying to kill. And in order for something to be a capital crime, that the beitin will enforce the penalty, then it has to be a case of it has to be that the person who was killed was the person that you were trying to kill. Rabbi Abraham ben David, who was a scholar who was slightly older than Rambam, and who thought that Rambam was a little bit of a whippersnapper, who came along with this law code and wrote all sorts of glosses of disagreement with Rambam's commentary and with Rambam's text. Rambam had the bad fortune that virtually every printer who has printed Rambam's code of law has printed it together with the glosses of Rabad disagreeing with the Rambam. And so Rabad writes here, well, this is the opinion of Rabbi Shimon in the Talmud, but halacha does not follow Rabbi Shimon's opinion. In other words, we see that this whole issue in the halachic literature of nitkaven laharog et zeh v'harag et zeh is a disagreement in the Babylonian Talmud, and it is also a disagreement in later halachic literature. Rambam thinks that the halacha is that it is not a capital crime, and Rabban thinks that it is a capital crime, and it all comes down to the interpretation of these first words in the verse. I am thinking, considering that it is 12 minutes to the hour, that this, and I see that there are a lot of comments in the chat, that this might be a good place to stop just before we get into the part of the discussion that is, I think, the most fascinating part of the discussion about this text, which is, what does it say about fetuses? And that will be where we will start our class next week. I don't think it makes sense to get into that part of the discussion now at this point. So I will now open up the chat and see what the comments have come in here. Today we have new rabbinites, not from rabbi, but from rabbin. Okay. Who is more likely to kill a slave, the master and his family or outsiders? I don't know. That's an interesting question. Who is more likely to do it? But I do know what the halachic literature says. The halachic literature said that this leniency, that if the slave doesn't die on the spot, then it's not considered a capital crime. The halachic literature, the Talmud already says very clearly that this is only in the case where the person disciplining the slave is the master, but if it was somebody else, there is no, if you are giving a beating to somebody else's slave, the leniency does not apply. Yehudit says that Nakam could be referring to Goel Hadam. That's an interesting interpretation. The vengeance could be the assumption that the slave can have family members who will go and try to avenge them. That could be. And Yehudit also says, Lafia Pshat, Parshat Mishpatim, Ein Musag Evet Knani. Yehudit, I agree with you that on the Pshat level, that is the case. But since we are not Karaite Jews, I assume that pretty well everybody here is a Rabbinite Jew. In the Rabbinite tradition, the text was read as really discussing two different kinds of slaves. And what about beating of one's children, spouse, etc.? Well, sadly, there are different opinions about this in various halachic works over the years. I would say that the Jewish attitude towards beatings, not of slaves, is no worse than and slightly better than what one found in the cultures around the Israelites. People are hearing an echo. I'm sorry about that. Sword denotes intention to kill. Rod to discipline. Yes, I would agree that is what is happening here. Or maybe John moved. Maybe the reason that I failed to kill John when I was intending to kill John is because he moved. That could be. But either way, the question is whether for something to be considered intentional homicide, whether it has to be the intention to kill and the intention to kill the person who ended up getting killed. So who do we follow, Rambam or Rabban? I don't know if there's ever been a trial that has taken place in a Beit Din on this issue. So I think that people discuss these things in the Beit Midrash about what the halacha is in this case, but I don't know there's any fixed halacha on this issue. Okay, anybody have any oral comments that they want to make at this point? You can unmute yourself if you want.
Okay. If there isn't, then I will see you all next week, and we will get to the meaty part of this text that we began today, the discussion of whether the Torah is attempting to make a distinction between a fetus and a full-fledged human being. Stay tuned, and that's what we will look at next week, and see you all then.
Thank you so much, and sorry about anybody that was having a little bit of a sound issue. I'm not sure if it was everybody or just a couple of you, but we sent messages to anybody that thought that they were having some echo issues, and I'm not sure if Dr. Lockshin's microphone was just acting up a bit for a couple of you, but maybe we'll ask him to sit a little closer next time, and that will that will rectify the issue for anybody.
Remind me next week.
Okay, I will. We will. Okay, Glean Eater, we will remind you. Okay, thank you so much, and everyone have a wonderful week. Stay cool. All the best.